Good evening, everyone, and welcome to Radio Edutalk. This is David Noble in Dalgetty Bay, and delighted to welcome on to the Professional Learning for Teachers channel this Thursday evening, Sheila Hay, who's a teacher over in Edinburgh. Good evening, Sheila.
Evening, David.
Okay, and great to have you on the show for the next half hour or so, and we're just going to kind of delve into your professional learning over the past few years and learn a bit about, among other things, some kind of pointers on how to work successfully with more able pupils, and we'll be looking at a few other aspects of your practice over your years as a primary teacher in Edinburgh. I'll just say that if you are listening to the live show or indeed the podcast, you can get in touch and pose a question or a comment to Sheila. There's two ways to get in touch. You can put something on Twitter and include the hashtag edutalk, that's EDUTALK, or you can email the show at edutalker, that's EDUTALKR, at talkmail.co.uk. Sheila, could you just start by giving us a kind of brief background to your career in education?
Yeah. This is my 40th year of teaching. I've always taught in the same school on the west side of Edinburgh. I did spend 1 year in Australia as an exchange teacher, and the Australian teacher taught in my school in Edinburgh, which was a fabulous experience for me. I've always been a class teacher, a full-time class teacher with full-time class commitment. This year I'm doing support for learning throughout the school, which again is a new experience for me that I'm thoroughly enjoying. I've taught all stages, I've taught composite classes, and I've always felt, some people say, do you not get bored? But I never get bored because it's new children every year. Sometimes the content's the same, but the way the children react every year is different. So that's why I've always enjoyed what I've been doing, and that's where I am.
That's fantastic, and you kind of sent me a kind of background to some of your professional learning over the years, and I was particularly interested to hear that you took part in a study visit to Toronto around the theme of involving and supporting parents. So could you tell us a bit more about the kind of context, the lead up to the study visit, and then your experiences and how things changed for you when you kind of brought back your reflections and new practices to your school?
Yes, I saw this advertised, a study visit to Canada, and I applied for it. It was a week-long study visit to Toronto in Canada during the October holiday. And before I went, I had to do a bit of reading, obviously, to find out get some professional reading before I went. And that I found really interesting. Then we went to London and met all the other people who were going on the visit. But that was even more interesting because you got a lot of interesting things from different people, found out what they were doing already, because I always find the word of mouth, much as reading articles is very interesting, and yet the academic learning is valuable too, but I always find it's the actual teachers who give you the ideas that is the most valuable of all. When we got over to Canada, we were taken round a variety of schools. We were given a fair number of lectures as well. But again, for me, the most valuable bits were when we went into school, saw the teachers working, and actually got to speak to the parents. Now, it was their attitude in Canada was, I found, quite different from our attitude in Scotland, in that we saw a lot of parents working in the classrooms, whereas we tend in Scotland to, in certainly in my own school, we're very worried about confidentiality. So parents are in short supply. When I mentioned confidentiality to some of the parents in the Canadian schools, they looked quite puzzled in that we're all here to help the children. Why would we go outside and talk about somebody's child? So I found that very interesting, and something that when I came back, I did do some more reading on. And again, some of the things people that are cited in the literature is work commitments, lack of confidence in approaching teachers, but mainly their painful experiences of their own school days seem to be what holds us back in Scotland, whereas I'm thinking Canada being a younger country, a lot of migrants to the country, they maybe have a different attitude to it. But certainly some of the ideas that are brought back that we've been able to put into practice in our own school, things like putting out all the letters on the one day, because we find we have a lot of newsletters going out to children, letters in children's school bags, and they don't get read. So one of the ideas we saw was putting them all out on the one day and calling it Mail Day, alerting the parents to look for this coming. One of the other things that we saw was in the mornings, in some schools, they wouldn't have bells, they had music instead, and the children would make announcements through the loudspeakers systems. Now, in my school in Edinburgh, we are lucky to have a loudspeaker system, so that was something that we could try out, and the children loved it. One of the other things I found, though, was I personally went out into the playground to ask the parents what they thought of this idea. And at first, when I went out, I could almost see them walking backwards away from me. Mm-hmm. But when I approached them and asked them what did they think about the music idea, their faces changed and they were just so delighted to be asked. So again, I felt that reinforced what I'd read in the literature, that parents lack confidence in approaching teachers, and they may be experiences of their own school days, but I think we need to be seen to be more welcoming and trying to get them to come in, which is definitely something that they seem to have sussed in Canada.
Mm-hmm. So, and I'm kind of putting you in the spot here, Sheila, but with your experience, do you feel that we're starting to or have previously or recently broken this kind of cycle then, that hopefully in the future, you know, those youngsters who are leaving school now, when they become parents, you know, will be happy to engage with schools even if they didn't necessarily achieve academically? Or do you think these problems, in your eyes and maybe in your own setting or as far as you can see elsewhere, persist?
I'd like to think we've broken the cycle. I'd like to think the younger parents, and certainly in our own setting, they seem much more willing to come into workshops to find out what's going on, because every parent wants what's best for their child. So certainly the younger ones seem keen to come in and find out what's going on, how we teach things. And I think it's just the slow drip that over time that we may have turned it around. But I think we're only going to break the cycle by actually approaching parents and making ourselves amenable to parents and welcoming them in. I'd like to think that small, each individual teacher will have to play their own part in that. I don't know if it's going to happen over Scotland. Mm-hmm. Totally, it'll take time, like everything. Mm-hmm. But I think we are on the right track.
Mm-hmm. Moving on now, Sheila, I noticed that you'd written during your chartered teacher submission a few years back that you'd been learning about and then implementing practices around De Bono's thinking hats. Now, maybe because I'm kind of traditionally secondary trained and I like to kind of expose myself to kind of ideas that appear to work and across a variety of settings, but it's something I've never got round to actually implementing. So for my own benefit, and maybe that of some of our listeners, could you just take us through what the bonus thinking hats are, and again how you've put that into practice, and maybe a little bit about how successful it's been?
Yes, well, I've actually only tried it out with our own staff, and I've learned about it first when I was in Australia, Edward de Bono's Six Thinking Hats, and the idea is that it's based upon the beliefs of Tibetan monks who spin prayer wheels even when the inclination to pray isn't there. So the belief is that if you go through the motions, in time, your emotions will catch up with your actions, right? In the same way that if you smile, you actually feel happier. So if you take up the pose of a thinker, then the thinking will follow. So it's to encourage people to think in a deliberate way, because We've got the reactive automatic thinking that we use for coping, and it's just like following a map. And then we've got the deliberate thinking, which is like making the map. So it's to give, it's to suggest that people think in a particular kind of way. And by giving them the hat, it gives them the freedom to speak in certain ways, so that everybody gets a chance to be heard, and everybody gets a chance to give a particular kind of thought. So, for example, if you're told you're putting on the red hat, now the red hat's the hat for the emotions and the feelings and the intuitions, so you don't have to justify or explain your feelings. You can just say, I want to make a red hat statement. I feel that we're being bullied into an agreement that we don't want. So it gives you the right to make these feelings visible. In the same way that the black hat, if you say I'm speaking with the black hat, that's the logical or the negative thinking hat. So it's not just criticism for criticism's sake. It's, it lets people know that they have a chance to say something and they don't have to interject all the time. They're going to be told, right, I want you all to put on your black hat, or I want you all now to put on your yellow hat, which is the making things happen or to make things better hat. It's the hat that's concerned with getting the job done. Now, the green hat is the creative thinking hat. So that's the one that's humorous and innovative, and you don't shoot down people for having unusual ideas. So if you're, if the person has said you're wearing this hat, then they have the floor, and it's everybody's opportunity to speak in that kind of way. And the blue hat is the blue sky thinking hat, which is usually the chairperson in the room. So they take on this role, and everybody's told which hat they're wearing. Now, you can actually, when I saw it done in Australia, the teacher that was doing it with a group of students actually had these different coloured hats and told the student to put on the particular hat when they were debating a subject. And they, so they each had to say, this is my red hat thinking, or this is my blue hat thinking, or with my yellow hat on, and give their opinion. So it was really good for getting communication going, but the underlying idea was to get them thinking in a particular kind of way. So it seemed very effective. Very effective as an observer when I was watching it. Mm-hmm. And the staff in school, when I tried it out at a staff meeting, they did enjoy it. It did take longer, but it did. It was quite creative, and it gave everybody the chance to speak. But it wasn't continued week after week, I have to be honest.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, that's, I mean, it's absolutely, absolutely fascinating.
It's a fascinating thing to do, yeah, mm-hmm. It is.
Yeah. It doesn't sound very Scottish, though. It sounds like quite a big kind of change of mindset would be needed to actually maybe sustain that kind of approach to meetings or class discussions.
Yes, and it means everybody has to buy into it initially, and everybody has to see what they want to see, but nobody has to be shot down. So it encourages people who want to always take a back seat to come forward as well, and not feel that they're exposing themselves because they're saying, as I wear this hat.
Yeah.
So it does have a purpose. But I agree with you, it's kind of against the Scottish psyche, mm-hmm. So it might take a while before it catches on.
But in saying that, it does sound like an advance on the kind of no-hands-up idea. It's a bit more complex, a bit more kind of benefits.
But this is the way, again, when I saw this first done, it was in 2000, David, and it was revolutionary for me, because I hadn't done any kind of advanced level studies before I had gone to Australia. I had been a classroom teacher all my working life, and I decided to do this at a certain stage in my life. I thought I would go to Australia and do this, and because I was there on a study exchange, I had to write a report on it. So I needed to do some research, and I chose this because I had done some work on it before I went, But again, once I got there, it was so fascinating because I went to different schools, and each school I went to speak to a teacher would then say to me, oh, you must go and see Mrs. So-and-so. She's doing fabulous work at the next school. And it went on and on and on. It was like branches on a tree. And the De Bono's hat was just one of the things that I saw in one of the schools. And when I came back here, I realized it was already over here, but in my ignorance, I hadn't known this because I hadn't done any reading or research. So for me, this was the beginning of a journey, which then took me on when I came back to becoming a chartered teacher and keeping up with the reading and the research and enjoying it.
What I'll say at this point, whether you're listening to the live stream or the podcast, just a reminder that you're listening to Sheila Hay, who's a chartered teacher in Watsonna Primary School in Edinburgh. I'll just say again, whether it's live or the podcast, if you go to edutalk.cc, you'll also see a link to just a single sheet relating to tonight's show. It just gives you a couple of recommended pieces of reading that Sheila suggested, and also a couple of reflective questions that we might come on to later. Sheila's posed a couple of questions to our good listeners. First of all, Sheila asks, have we forgotten to ensure that NQTs have the basic craft skills of teaching reading and numeracy? And Sheila's second question is, while all parents want the best for their child and the Scottish Government wants the best for its future citizens, are we in danger of raising expectations above what is humanly possible to be delivered by a mass education system? So we'll talk about them later on. And there's also a few links to the new standard for career-long professional learning. You're somebody who's over your career at various points has looked into improving the educational experience of more able pupils. So can you just talk around that a bit, about the kind of experience that you've picked up and maybe your kind of key pointers for listeners, or your kind of philosophy behind making it an excellent educational experience for these types of pupils in your school?
Yeah, again, the first course I went on, and I seem to talk about a lot of courses, because we did go on a lot of courses over my years, but many of them were not of a very good standard. But I have to say, the first one that really blew my mind was one for supporting more able pupils, and that's when I learned about the multi-intelligences. Now, the gifted and talented was one of the titles given to a paper given to us in Edinburgh, but it's not really the gifted children, because gifted children are few and far between, and they need special lessons set for them, and they need to be stretched in a totally different way. But the more able pupils can often be forgotten in a class and are often just given more of the same kind of work, which just turns them off. The more able pupils need to be stretched in a different way. And I always find that if you tap into their curiosity, and if you are curious about things, you can lead them to be curious about things and set them off to do a lot of independent learning. And especially now with ICT, and I had to be dragged kicking and screaming into ICT, because I started off in the days of the Banda Master and the BBC computers. Mm-hmm. But I can tell you that I can see the advantages of technology nowadays and how everything is at hand, because no school can have all the resources that it really needs or it would ideally wish for. But with computers and the internet, the more able pupils can be sent off to do independent research, and as long as you're there to spark their curiosity, point them in the right direction, ask them open-ended questions, so that they don't just come back with a yes-no answer, and they know that they can be creative about how they do it, so it doesn't always have to be write a report. They use their different intelligences so they can come back, they can write music, they can make models. So it's tapping into all of their senses and tapping into all of their abilities. Because again, I foolishly, when I first started out, or naively, concentrated only on the linguistic and the number talents. But there are many, many more, and that's the ones that teachers often forget about, that children can be very good in, on the sports field, or very good at making models, or very good at writing stories, or writing music, or, you know, in all these different ways. So we need to be pressing all their buttons, in a way, and making all these things available to them, but allowing them to take it in their own way.
And
I think that's the advantage nowadays.
Was your kind of spark in this area, did that come from the work of, for example, Howard Gardner?
Yes, well, Howard Gardner was what I was introduced to when I went on my first course, when Edinburgh started all this. I'm just flicking through for the lady's name. Mrs. Jean Kane. Now, she came to talk to us from Glasgow University, and she introduced us to the work of Howard Gardner and the multi-intelligences. And that was the first time I'd ever heard of this. And it just was so mind-blowing to me. But also, I was in a room of other enthusiastic teachers. And again, it brought home to me that you have to get the teachers to buy into whatever it is you're trying to get them to deliver. Just putting on a course, if you don't deliver it in an enthusiastic way and get the teachers to be enthusiastic about it, it's not going to cascade back into the schools, and it's not actually going to permeate down to the children. Just turning up at a course isn't enough. You have to see that it gets back into the classroom and actually works for the children, or doesn't work for the children, but at least that they try it out.
Yeah, I'm kind of curious. It was about 9 or 10 years ago. I was really getting into Gardner's stuff, and I remember I think it was the Usher Hall he came to, anyway. It was somewhere in the centre of Edinburgh, and he wowed a crowd of around about 500, I think. I just don't know, though, from you know, my kind of limited observations. I mean, I'm still, you know, full-time class committed, but I don't get out too often, but I don't see too much of a legacy. Or was it just was it a fad to an extent, you know, even if the kind of science was fairly sound in education circles, is that kind of phase past and we're on to other things now, or do you feel that it still has kind of standpoint and has multi-intelligences, which were then expanded greatly again, I think, into you know, well over the original half dozen or dozen or so. Do you think it's still relevant, or still resonates with teachers?
I think it's still relevant. I think even if we stick to just three, you know, even if we just stick to the visual, the auditory, and the kinesthetic, and every teacher can make sure that all these things are available in every class, I'm sold on it. I think the multi-intelligence is definitely needed to be addressed. I think we need to look at pupils in all those ways and not just about pushing them through exams. And one of the things that he did say when I heard him on an audio link, he has said that pushing the teaching of numbers and letters down to the nursery was a mistake. But this is contrary to the policy that we are pursuing in Edinburgh nurseries now. So someone's interpreted the research differently, but I'm personally on Howard Gardner's side on that.
Mm-hmm. We're just coming into the last 5 minutes or so. There was a piece of written work around your chartered teacher submission that I read recently. You stated that values must be intrinsic to a teacher and they will not be picked up during teacher training. Can you just say a bit more about that?
Yes, I think over the years I've probably mentored many students, and when we started off we were always called the craft teachers, so we knew all about the technical things about teaching in the classroom, but we didn't know much about the theory behind it. We knew what to do, but we didn't really understand why we were doing it. But nevertheless, I felt intrinsic to us were the values of honesty, integrity, charity, compassion, generosity. And I'm reading these as a list from DCARE, But on the other hand, if that's not part of you as a person, you're not going to pick those up in the classroom. And I think they should be published as an expectation of students so that they know that this is important to the job rather than just so many hires at A level. I think there's more to the job than just being academically qualified, that you need to be able to relate to the students as a person, and if they don't see you as an honest person in your dealings with them, the children are not going to pick up these values. But if they're not intrinsic to the person coming forward to be a teacher, there's no course in the world that's going to impart these values.
Mm-hmm. I mean, that's, you know, really, I think that's quite a strong statement that you're making, and I would imagine that many people, you know, will agree with you, Sheila. I'm just, does that mean, you know, are we fine in terms of PVG checks, in terms of, you know, maybe your limited experience of university admissions policies and things like that, or the code of conduct for teachers? Do you think what's there is sufficient to make sure that people who don't have these values don't get into the teaching profession, or, you know, are kind of drummed out, for want of a better phrase, out of the profession very early in their studentship or in their careers? Or do you think that more needs to be done? Is it to do with interview processes or something else?
I think that's it, David. I think the interview process, when they apply to the universities, it maybe could be teased out more. That just to make students aware of what's expected. So yes, the PVG checks and all the other things that we have in place, I think, are all very good. And I don't think a criminal would get away with anything. I mean, I think we've really got that nailed down. Mm-hmm. But I think that sometimes, I think, to be fair to the student teachers themselves, if they don't recognise that it's their whole personality that is the job, and it's not a 9-to-5 that you put on a persona for that time and go away again, it's all about you, the person, that I think it maybe needs to be spelled out more in the interview at university.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And just kind of moving on from that, your second question that you posed about danger of raising expectations above what is humanly possible to be delivered by a mass education system. You know, I think I know what you're getting at there, but again, do you just want to say a bit more, and you know, whether does this relate to the new curriculum or associated developments, or are you actually making a criticism of the system of itself? Is it not individualised enough? Is there not enough supports where they need to be?
Yeah, I think in my own situation in schools where the classes are numbers are creeping up again towards the 33 maximum, and with the advances in medicine that we've seen with children coming into schools with many more complex needs, to meet those needs in the mainstream classroom, to meet every single child's needs in the mainstream classroom is the one that I'm struggling with. Is it humanly possible by one teacher and perhaps one or two classroom assistants and various visiting teachers coming in with various areas of expertise? While our policy is getting it right for every child, I just don't think we can create, I don't think we can deliver a bespoke system for every child in the way that we are more of a mass system of education, where we're delivering a lesson, we're differentiating the lesson as much as possible, but no teacher can split herself into these 33 parts. Mm-hmm. And that's the bit that I'm struggling with, mm-hmm. to see if we're in danger of promising parents something that we actually can't physically, humanly deliver.
And the kind of million-dollar question, I mean, are there any solutions out there? Are you seeing, you know, other establishments that are getting it right for every child, or do you think this is a problem that exists, you know, throughout the country, you know, based around, you know, good intentions initially?
Oh, I'm sure it must be being found around the country, but I think there will be creative ways of solving it, and that's where I think when teachers get together, for example, at the conference that the Chartered Teachers are running on the 1st of March, again, when teachers get together and the teachers share ideas with other teachers, I will learn something at that conference. Mm-hmm. We'll all learn new things and maybe new ideas of ways of making it more manageable. And at the end of the day, it's all about making it more manageable so that the children get the best possible education they can get. Because they only get one chance at it.
Absolutely.
And it's always been my aim to give them the best possible chance. Mm-hmm. There's no second chances for them. Yeah. So that is my reason for being in the classroom, is to make it as good as possible. So I won't stop trying.
Yeah.
But it's hard going, but I'm sure there might be some teachers out there that have got other ideas that will help me in my situation, and I might be able to spread it around other teachers too.
Yeah. And just finally then, maybe if you, in a moment, just give us a few more details and give listeners a few more details about the Chartered Teacher Conference that's coming up. But just before you do so, Sheila, you know, you've taken us through some of the kind of key moments in your professional learning journey over recent years, but you know, how has charter teacher status kind of influenced you then, and how do you I suppose live your life or go to work as a charter teacher? You know, what kind of effect has that had on you, and what impact do you feel that you continue to have as a chartered teacher?
Well, I think it certainly gave me a confidence in my own abilities, because, again, one of the other phrases that I picked up was, sometimes you're too busy down in the swamp to get out and see the bigger picture. And I was always so busy in my classroom doing for the children in my class that year, to giving them what I thought was the best possible education, that I never got out of the swamp long enough to see the bigger picture. And undertaking the Chartered Teacher course, becoming a Chartered Teacher, meeting other Chartered Teachers, and keeping up with meeting other Chartered Teachers and going to different conferences and things, it's given me lots of new ideas. It gave me a fresh impetus to speak to other teachers and be able to say what I thought, be able to question things that before I had just accepted. For me, it was a wonderful thing. It gave me a new spring in my step, to be honest. I always loved being in the classroom, but it's given me a chance to interact with other teachers and other enthusiastic teachers and just keep on learning. So even in my 40th year, I'm still learning and I'm still enjoying it.
Fantastic. And so tell us about the, as much as you can, I suppose, sell it to Sheila, the Chartered Teacher Conference on Saturday the 1st of March.
The Chartered Teachers Conference is taking place on the 1st of March. It's for all teachers, it's by teachers, for teachers, but there's a fabulous lineup of speakers. We've got Mike Russell, who's going to open the conference for us. We've got Petra Wend. We've got Graham Donaldson's coming along. We've got, those are the main keynote speakers. We've got some fabulous keynote speakers, but there's also loads of workshops. There's about 16 workshops taking place, all run by teachers for teachers. Mm-hmm. So it costs £25 for anyone who's not a member, and for anybody, for all teachers, £25. A full-day conference, 9:30 to 3:30, fabulous lunch included. It's at Stirling Management Centre. And if you want to go onto the ACTS website, You'll see the full flyer with full details, and anyone can come along. And please do.
That's fantastic. And if I remember right, the web address, which you'll hear me keying in at the moment to find out details of how to book a place, is acts.edublogs, that's edublogs.org. And yeah, I can certainly recommend it, and I'm looking forward to going along myself.
Good, thank you for that, David. I wouldn't have had the email address, I'm afraid.
So that's the web address, and then the email address is actscotland@yahoo.com. There you go, my memory's
brilliant.
My memory's
there,
not
you go. Well
in.
Done, thank you.
Well, listen, thank you so much for joining us this evening, Sheila.
Not at all, and, it's a pleasure.
I'll just say again, if you're listening to a podcast and you want to contribute, then you just put something on Twitter with the hashtag edutalk, or get in touch via the usual email address. So good to talk to you, Sheila, and I'll see you in a few weeks, and best wishes for the future.
Okay, thank you very much, David.
Thanks, Sheila.
Good night.
Bye.